representative from Silverton.
And Arne Roblin, senator from District 5, which is Coos Bay to Tillamook Bay.
Okay. Starting with you.
Nick Carrera, Committee Assistant,
Community
Services.
So is Nick Carrera, Committee Assistant. Thank you. And starting over here.
Matt, Assistant to Senator Monix Anderson.
Great.
Joe Greenman, General Counsel, Oregon Healthcare Association.
Valerie Harmon, Patient Safety Consultant from the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. Lynn Dubucci, Patient Safety Consultant from the Oregon Patient Safety Commission. And Director of
Oregon Healthcare. Craig Smith, Oregon Construction Contractors Board.
Bill Olson, Advocacy Coalition of Seniors and People with Disabilities.
Trevor Simmons, Adult Foster Home Association.
Trace Hutchinson, Adult Protective Services Manager at OAPI, the Office of Adult Abuse Prevention and Investigation. Kathy Schultz, Assistant to Baker, Representative Baker.
Courtney Johnson, Legislative Aid to Representative Alba.
Gail Meyer, the Legislative Representative for the Criminal Defense Lawyers Association.
Alyssa Seidlick, Legislative Counsel.
Becky Strauss, ACLU of Oregon.
John Bartholomew, Alzheimer's Association, Oregon Chapter.
Ms. McHugh with the Oregon Disabilities Commission.
And Kevin, you came in just in time to make a grand introduction, so.
I'm Kevin Christensen with the Oregon Technology Association.
Perfect. Well, with that, do we have a quorum? We do not. So we will not be adopting work group rules or electing our co-chairs until we have an actual quorum. So we'll open, we'll unofficially open the informational meeting just for informational purposes, but not actually open the meeting because we haven't adopted our rules yet. So we're just going to move on in an informational fashion and have Mary Yeager, John Wentworth, and Matt Smith give us an overview of House Bill 2205. Mary.
I'm Detective Smith, would you like to start?
No.
No, it says here that you start, Mary Yeager, right here.
Mary, if I can interrupt.
Sure.
Co-chair. While you're getting your wheels going, mine aren't going yet. I do want to make sure everyone realizes that we have two new legislative members, and they are to my left, Senator Canope and Senator Roblin. And I'm going to put them on the spot just for a second because we had a nice pre-meeting yesterday, and I appreciated what they had to say about their interest in what we're doing, and maybe you could give a short introduction of yourselves. Senator? I guess I can start. Senator Roblin from Coos Bay, and prior to getting in the legislature, I was a high school principal, and what you get to find out as a high school principal is that a lot of our students in high school now are raised by grandparents. They find themselves in this unique situation of raising a second family, and in some of those cases, the young people that are sent to them are not appreciative of their grandparents. They were not appreciative of their parents. That's why they ended up with their grandparents at times. And so there were a lot of situations in which I felt, as a principal, there was really abusive situations going on at home with these young high school students with these grandparents. And we tried to intercede and tried to figure out how we could give them the tools they needed to work with and to have those students understand how important it was for them to understand what the grandparents were giving up to make them have a safe environment to live in and to go to school. And so we had those kinds of conversations. And also as a when my second term as a legislature, I had a situation in one of my small communities where a very, very nice woman had an older home that was falling apart. A person came by and said, hey, I'd like to help you. You know, just a meal, a place to sleep, I'll fix your porch and do that stuff. So he did, and he worked there for probably a month and did a lot of different things, and then mentioned that, you know, it'd be really nice to fix your roof, and I'd be glad to do that as well. But it would be a lot easier for me to go down to the store and get materials if you signed your house over to me, which she did. And then he had her evicted from her home that her husband and her had been in for 50 years. And at the end of the day, there was no recourse because she was a sound body and mind. She made the decision, and there was nothing to do. And it was a very hopeless helpless situation that I felt as a legislator trying to figure out how to solve a problem that was not solvable. And then just in this course of my 8 years in the House, my first year in the Senate, the number of situations that have come up make it really, really important. My mother-in-law was a bank teller, and she talked about a lot of things up in Washington and situations that happened over the years that were very, very frustrating for her to watch and see. So it's been through all those circumstances, though, when the bill came forward, I found it, I thought it would be, this would be a good committee to be on. Maybe we can continue to do things that make some of our most vulnerable people have a much better end-of-life experience. So that's why I'm here.
Thank you.
Senator
Knope. Senator Knope from Senate District 27 of Bend, Redmond, Tumalo, and Sun River. And my interest in this is that as our population ages, they become much more vulnerable. I mean, people are very vulnerable when they're very young and as we get older. Ann's point has really been driven home to me in a very close way, in that I think it's really incumbent upon us to attempt to prevent and work on elder abuse prevention. And one of the issues in terms of prevention is in the arena of dementia and Alzheimer's. As the population ages, there is more likelihood that people are going to be abused as they are unable to care for themselves and rely on other people for care. And that point was driven home because, you know, a close family member has walked away from home 3 times and been unable to find their way back. And if we can work to prevent that or help that situation, and I think we can, and I certainly want to have that discussion at some point in this work group. But I think it's critical that we work on these issues before they become huge problems, and we're all going to get there. And you know, some of us faster than others, but
right.
That's right.
I accept that.
Yeah, I'm just a youngster, but we're all going to get there. And we need to be ready and try to get ahead of the curve versus react to it as it becomes more of a significant problem in society. And so my interest in this is to try to do the best we can for the people who have who have lived great lives and given us the opportunity to pursue our dreams. I think we ought to make sure that we're doing all we can to make their experiences the best that they can be and keep them from becoming victims, as Senator Roblin said. That is just one story of thousands that are out there of people who are attempting to abuse and rip them off, either financially or physically.
Thank you very much.
Glad you're here. Yeah, we really appreciate it and appreciate you stepping up to serve on the committee. We've managed, as I said before, to get a lot done and work in a bipartisan, bicameral manner, and looking forward to continuing to do so. So with that, now that we've given you time to prep, Mary Yeager.
I think everybody here has a copy of 2205. And as I'm often reminded, I'm not a lawyer, so we'll let the lawyers take the lawyer part and Detective Smith take the more police action part. But just to catch everybody up to speed, one of the functions of this bill is to actually keep the work group going. It may not be apparent to the outside folks, but there was tremendous amounts of goodwill and time and big brains that brought these issues forward under the wonderful guidance of our co-chairs. But to your point, Senator, Judge Tennyson, who isn't here with us this morning, often reminds us that the protection for seniors and elders is still 30-plus years behind in Oregon, behind child abuse, which we all know has tremendous problems. So I think everybody in the room is really willing to work together to have some wonderful results come out of this. So 2205 reappoints the work group. It is actually two derivations from what started as an awful article in the Oregonian. And then director, still director, Aaron Kelly Seald pulled together a work group that looked at a wide variety of abuses, but culminated in 4084, which was the precursor to this bill. Here we are, a lot of smart folks ready to work under all of your direction and see what we can accomplish for Oregonians. How's that?
That's good.
I'd like to now turn it over to Detective Smith to go over the more law enforcement related sections of the bill. Detective Smith.
Well, I'm humbled to serve on your work group. I can tell you that so far House Bill 4084 and 2205 I've actually utilized several times. Recently there was an individual who was even serving as a judge in two different cities who perpetuated an enormous amount of elder abuse, and some of the provisions that are outlined in this bill assisted me in that investigation, because if anything the bill bought me some time during my investigation. Most of our senior citizens with dementia are suffering in silence, and what ultimately happens is that the situation becomes so out of control and so egregious that it becomes the attention of Adult Protection Services or law enforcement, and by that point you find out the abuse has been going on for years. Prior to these House bills being passed, your statute of limitations was 3 years. It's now six. That by itself buys law enforcement and the district attorney's office just some time to go through financial records, because most of the cases I deal with are financial. The second component that we worked on was the ability to streamline law enforcement's ability to obtain a subpoena for bank records and medical records. In Washington County, I was writing 50, 60-page search warrant affidavits, which would take me days at a time to do, and then I would have a DA review it, and once it was approved, I would then take it to a judge if I could find one that was available. The provisions in this House bill allows law enforcement to go down in front of a grand jury and just simply testify under oath, essentially testify verbally to your affidavit, and have a grand jury decide whether they're going to issue a subpoena or not. If anything, it just makes the process of investigating elder abuse cases more efficient, and as this bill is more often utilized, I believe it's going to make these cases progress faster. One of the common complaints I hear from citizens is, why is it taking so long for my case to be investigated? One of the things I would hope and ask the work group to at least look at is something Mr. Wentworth and I have talked about offline several times, which is our frustrations with the issue of venue of elder abuse crimes, specifically criminal mistreatment in the first degree. As technology is becoming more prolific, we're seeing financial crimes perpetuated against senior citizens where we can't tell where the suspect is located at. We can't even tell where the transaction occurred at, where the computer was located at, or even where the suspect resides at. And it would be nice to get some permissive language in state law that would say, you know, venue for this crime is going to be where that senior citizen is residing. That way we don't have to worry about busing a senior citizen out of state to testify at a grand jury proceeding if the transaction occurred in Vancouver. We can do what we do with identity theft cases, which is make venue just simply where the person lives. And I think that's something that is doable, and one of my goals has been to try to find simple common sense additions to statute that's going to make law enforcement's job easier to hold these people accountable. And I would just ask that while this session and this work group works throughout the session, we just keep in mind if we can work in something where we can address this issue of venue.
Great. Mr. Wentworth.
Yes.
I think you're next. You're teed up next for the for bat and cleanup on this presentation.
Do we have the PowerPoint presentation up?
Nope, I'm sorry. I wasn't aware there was a PowerPoint presentation.
Oh, you sent that out?
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'll just speak to it then. To understand 2205 best, bear with me. I think it's helpful to go back and understand House Bill 4084 and what that accomplished and how that tied into what we did in 2205. So back in 2012, House Bill 4084 helped increase protections for senior citizens in Oregon by addressing issues like Detective Smith was talking about, for the ability for law enforcement to get access to financial records, medical records. It extended the statute of limitations on property crimes against vulnerable adults. it made it impossible for persons who have convictions for criminal mistreatment to get those convictions set aside so that we would be unable to identify those people down the line when they applied for work with vulnerable adults. And it helped create a list of permanently disqualifying crimes for people who have committed certain offenses to be able to work in that field again. So, for example, when we were talking about one of the accomplishments of 4084, the statute of limitations was convoluted, difficult to understand, and essentially provided, in some instances, just a 3 to 4 year window to prosecute crimes against senior citizens. And the problem was, as Detective Smith would tell you, oftentimes we learn about the commission of the crime years after it occurs, perhaps when other family members become more involved in a person's estate or soon to be estate because they're about to die, and the crimes have occurred years before, or even after the discovery of it. Just the investigation of some of these crimes can be extensive and take anywhere up to a year or even beyond that, because as you're aware, many law enforcement agencies don't have resources to dedicate to someone to just have, you know, investigate one particular case. They have a larger caseload. So that became a real impediment, and we found that there were a number of cases that we weren't able to prosecute simply because the statute of limitations had run. So 4084 extends the statute of limitations to 6 years to provide a reasonable amount of time for us to get the cases identified and investigated. As I was mentioning, it also prohibited expunction. If the victim was over 65 years of age at the time of the offense, anyone who had a conviction for criminal mistreatment or criminal mistreatment 2 could not have that crime expunged, so we can identify those people down the line. That's the way the law read for child victims of criminal mistreatment, but if the victim happened to be over the age of 65 prior to 4084, we would have no way of identifying people who had those convictions, so that provides greater protection. It also allowed us to get medical records more easily. HIPAA provided that there were two ways that law enforcement could get medical records. In cases of adult abuse or neglect, the healthcare provider could disclose if it believed disclosure was necessary to prevent further harm or if the victim was incapacitated. And the law enforcement officer represented that the information wouldn't be used against the victim, and the victim will be harmed if the information is not disclosed before the victim regains capacity. But there was a second provision that said, or as required by law. And Oregon didn't have any provision that allowed additional protection to seniors. And so what 4084 did was to create as required by law provision. And now when a law enforcement officer provides notice of an investigation of adult abuse, the provider must permit the officer to inspect and copy protected health information of the elderly person and to consult about the information. So the doctor and nurse is now free to give additional information, background work, before they wouldn't have been. We do not have to have the consent from the patient, the caregiver, the fiduciary, or any other legal representative to do that. It also addressed issues that law enforcement officers face with obtaining financial records. Previously, we could only get financial records with the consent of the victim or the perpetrator by subpoena as long as notice was provided to the customer. And so that became a sticking point, as you can imagine, once the caregiver who was on a joint account with the victim learned that that law enforcement was getting access to those financial records and provided an opportunity to drain the account and flee, or to adjust the account to make it look ways that it didn't actually start out before. So what 4084 did was allow us to get those records through a subpoena without notice to the customer if the officer determines that it's not in the victim's best interest to do so. And it provided some additional protection to the bank so that they weren't on the hook by providing that information to law enforcement. And it cut down the amount of time that banks had to provide that information. We're now down to 10 days. So we have a reasonable amount of time to get that information and begin the investigation right away. That all tied into 2205, those provisions that I just talked about had a sunset provision, and so 2205 was important in that it eliminated the sunset provision. So those are now, those with regard to medical records, financial records, statute of limitations, and expunction, all of those provisions are now Oregon law, and we don't have to worry about those sunsetting in some period down the road. But it also allowed for increasing the professional occupations that are required to mandatorily report elder abuse. It added legislators, dentists, optometrists, chiropractors, and for my purpose, attorneys as well. Some of those occupations were only, including attorneys, were only required to report elder abuse if the person, if the professional learned about that elder abuse in the course of their professional employment. So while if I'm out mowing my lawn on a Saturday, I see child abuse, as an attorney, I'm required to report that right away. But when we're talking about elder abuse, previously, I would not be required to report elder abuse if I saw it in that same situation. And so now we've brought it in line with child abuse. Those provisions take place or begin January 1st of 2015, so that the professional organizations can get that that word out and get whatever requirements they need to get that underway, and we can begin doing it in earnest. It also, 2205 also created a provision that allowed a district attorney to delegate the responsibility to develop a multidisciplinary team to some other designee or administrator who will be a member of the team. We're finding that in smaller counties, district attorneys were, many smaller offices don't have the budget, they don't have the personnel, they don't have the ability to sit on multiple multidisciplinary teams, and so the teams were not getting created. So what we wanted to do is provide a mechanism whereby the district attorney can delegate that responsibility to another agency, for example, Department of Human Services, so that we get these multidisciplinary teams underway and working in each of the counties. It's been a huge benefit to my county in terms of increasing collaboration and communication among agencies. I think it's going to be a good thing across the state, but we just weren't getting the help from the district attorneys that we needed, so 2205 addressed that. And then finally, one thing that will be of huge help to prosecutors, financial records are now admissible without the personal appearance of a custodian. So what we were learning is that many senior citizens have bank accounts that are out of state, and there was a evidentiary code provision that said that you had to have the custodian of records come in court and say, yep, those are the records that that I say they are. And so we were having to, in some cases, fly people in from Connecticut and other states for a five-minute hearing to say, yes, those are the records that I sent you. So what this does is it provides an affidavit that the custodian can fill out and declare that these are the records that I say they are. These are true copies of what I said they are, and therefore they are admissible in court. And so it'll streamline the prosecution process and provide one less tripwire that we have to avoid to get financial crimes prosecuted. So that's going to be a huge benefit to prosecutors.
Fantastic. Thank you. And I think, again, we want to thank you for your work. And one of the things that one of the overriding concerns that we had when we were looking at how do we combat elder abuse, what tools do we need, is the difference between the laws and regulations we have and protections we have around child abuse versus elder abuse. So we're really trying to bring those two things in line, and that has been constant throughout. If we're going to protect vulnerable people, not that all elders are vulnerable, we want to be clear about that, but we have elders who are vulnerable. We want to make sure that they have those same protections that we've given children. Also, want to acknowledge Senator Lori Moniz-Anderson. Thank you so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. So with that, we want to talk about, there are two things that we'd like to do in this work group between now and February. The first is to get a work group together to discuss and put forward a definition of abuse, because if we all have the same definition across all our ORSs and we all know what we're talking about, it makes it easier both for people to prosecute a crime and for people to defend themselves, and making sure that we have good definitions. And the second is the recommendations that we had coming out of that last work group were, one, that we have an integrated statewide call center. Now, we, the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, put money into the 211 system, and so we want to look at how do we integrate into that system so across the state you can have one number that people can call, as opposed to how many numbers are there in Clackamas County, like 46 or 43 different phone numbers, and that's just Clackamas County, and people don't know who to call. So this is important. And then also increasing public awareness and community education on what is elder abuse, specifically financial abuse, what are the symptoms people should look for. So we will be putting together two work groups, but for now we want to start a discussion of the definition of abuse, and with that we'd like to bring up Fred Steele and Joe Greenman. Did you know you were teed up? Okay. All right.
And especially for the folks on the phone, just re-identify where you are in name and so forth.
Do we have, for the people on the phone, do we need one of the microphones maybe over here by Joe and I?
That'd be a good idea. Let me do that.
Can we get some of those more distant people to maybe come a little closer to the phone so all of us can hear?
Yeah.
That's what we're doing.
Perfect.
All right. Janet?
Great work, thanks.
So we just moved one of the phone microphones. Hopefully you can all hear us. This is Fred Steele, the legal services developer with the Older Americans Act, under the Older Americans Act. I'm with the Department of Human Services. And my understanding was what I was asked to do today was to talk about, to some degree, why I was hired at the Department of Human Services. I was hired 5 years ago by the then director of the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division to specifically look at that time, the abuse definitions. At that time, we had 17 administrative rule definitions of abuse within the department alone. We had four definitions of, and this is all adult abuse. There were 17 adult abuse definitions, and there were four definitions of adult abuse within statute. Those four definitions in statute still persist. there is a definition for residents of nursing homes and what abuse entails for residents of nursing homes. There's a definition of elder abuse for people 65 and over. There is a definition, there is a single definition, but it breaks down into two categories of peoples, people with developmental disabilities and people with a mental illness. Within that abuse, there really are, that it's one abuse definition, but the way it breaks down, there really are two definitions within that of what abuse entails for those two individuals or those two populations. There's also shortcomings. There's no real reference to abuse protections for people in residential care facilities, assisted living facilities, adult foster homes. By default and through rulemaking power at the department, we extend the elder abuse definition for people 65 and older in those settings to apply to anybody in those settings, not just people 65 and over. But that's just kind of a quick breakdown of what the abuse definition looks like in statute. And again, why I was hired. I mean, there's some similarities in those definitions. There's definitely some differences in those definitions. And in the 5 years I've been at the department, the way that plays out is obviously there's some confusion over what does adult abuse mean in Oregon. Again, at the time we had 17 administrative rule definitions of abuse. We have that down to, I want to say it's the four to reflect what we have, essentially the four adult abuse definitions to reflect what's in statute, with some administrative rulemaking explanations of, how that plays out for protective services and, for long-term care facilities. The one real point that I want to make about, 5 years of you know, working on the abuse definitions going back to 2 years ago when this Oregon Elder Abuse Work Group first came together. And the point that I tried to make then and I'd want to make now because it still maintains is, you know, what are we trying to achieve with this abuse definition? First and foremost, protection of victims from abuse. And that persists. I mean, that should be and always will be, I think, I would assume, the primary goal of the abuse definition. When it was first created, the nursing home abuse definition was first created in 1979. The elder abuse definition, a very small rudimentary version of it, was created in 1981 by the legislature. Those definitions were made to protect victims. Since then, and really in the last 10 to 15 years, based on my research and studies that I did in the first couple of years of the department, and, you know, how do we tackle these definitions and how they play out, is how those definitions are used beyond protecting victims. So perpetrator accountability, whether that perpetrator is a facility or an individual in a facility or an individual family member in the community, that definition is being used to hold, more and more so. We're moving towards holding people accountable and perpetrators accountable when they commit abuse. That really is a much different use of those definitions and has to be considered with not only the definition itself, but also with the way that definition plays out in statute, the expectations, requirements of adult protective services, our regulatory bodies within the Department of Human Services, our long-term care facilities, people in the community, the DAs, the law enforcement officers that are using this, the Detective Smiths, how are we using these definitions for to hold perpetrators accountable? And then the third piece of that is quality and, quality improvement, quality of care in facilities in particular. How are we using this definition and, again, the statutory makeup that goes with those definitions and the way it plays out to improve quality of care? Again, you go back to the way the definition was first created in 79 and 1981. It was very focused on victim protections. And, again, that should be the first and foremost use of that definition. But the way it's evolved over the last 30 years is it's not necessarily, or arguably it's not necessarily functional for perpetrator accountability and quality improvement, or at least effectively or efficiently to achieve those things. So that's, from my perspective, what I hope to be able to achieve with this work group. I appreciate the opportunity to be on this work group since this is what I was hired to do 5 years ago at the department. My duties and obligations have evolved over the 5 years, but this is something that I definitely grew a passion about how do we use this definition? It starts with the definition, but it's really how do we use it? That's the real functional and true nature of, I think, what we can accomplish with this work group. So,
great. Thank you. Joe?
Thanks, Representative. I'm Joe Greenman, not Alan Clem, as the card in front of me says. I hope I can be as entertaining as Alan is sometimes. I've been involved in this discussion for as long or even longer than Fred has. I've really actually enjoyed working with Fred since they hired him at the department. He's been a really great partner from the department's perspective of offering expertise and a depth of understanding of not only the history of these statutes and administrative rules, but also the practice and process of how they're actually implemented by the staff at the Department of Human Services. So we've really enjoyed a lot of lengthy discussions about this, and there have been times in the past actually where Fred and I have had some discussions about legislative concepts on how these statutes and rules might be reformed and amended. So I think that we probably have a good starting off point for some of those. I bring forward the perspective of over 600 long-term care facility providers throughout the state of Oregon as their general counsel. And so one of my roles at OHCA that we joke about is that I man the bat phone, which means basically our members call, they have access to me as an attorney, and I provide them some technical expertise and advice, I hope, to help them through the various regulatory issues that they deal with, one of which is abuse investigations. And one of the common themes of our abuse statute and then the corresponding administrative rules that come from them is that they have a lot of overbreadth and complexity. And by that I mean I see consistently situations where there are adverse events and there are accidents that occur within long-term care facilities where residents do suffer harm and injury as a result of them, or they possibly could have, but there was a lucky circumstance, but no injury occurred, but certainly an opportunity to review practices and policies and systems to maybe prevent future occurrences of such issues. But in our abuse statute, in our abuse system, we have an investigatory process that essentially labels all of those circumstances, if they rise to the level of the definition, as abuse. And abuse in our system is an umbrella term for a whole litany of adverse events that include, like for instance, neglect is under abuse in our state. So if we have medication errors or resident falls or even sometimes financial exploitation, which can be the result of a resident wanting to give a gift to a caregiver, things that certainly we want a regulatory process in place for to have some transparency and to deal with those things and bring those issues to the fore, but perhaps not to label them as abuse. And we had this work group commissioned a Resident Safety Review Council to commission a report, and one of the things that came out in that report is the stigma of the term abuse is counterproductive. And I know that from personal experience, because my members, when they come to me, the one regulatory citation that aggravates them the most, by far, is to be labeled abuser. That has a major stigma. It is a scarlet letter. There is no doubt about it. And they are more inclined to avail themselves of attorneys and the due process system as a result of that, beyond any other sort of regulatory sanction that we have in our system. So that's kind of, you know, where we come from the standpoint that we'd prefer a system where we actually enhanced some transparency within it. We want transparency. One of the other problems that we've identified in our system is that providers are actually responsible for self-reporting. So that means providers are responsible for understanding this fairly complex definition of abuse and deciding when circumstances are in their facility, is this abuse, is it not, do I call it in, do I not call it in? I think that, you know, there might be a way to work on that where we actually just have more reporting with the assurance on the provider side that some of these things that don't have the underlying intent to be called abuse won't be categorized as abuse, but there will be an opportunity to work with the regulators to understand an incident did occur here. We do need to properly categorize it, whether it be an adverse event, whether it be neglect, whether it be actual abuse, and then, you know, work together on a preventive system to deal with that. You know, I would compare it, for instance, to the child system, where if you have abuse that gets categorized, it's essentially a likely criminal sanction. It's in our criminal code, and it's a possible situation where a child is going to get removed from custody of the parents. In our civil system, because of its extensive breadth of the definition, you have many more citations of abuse, but obviously, because it's so much more broad, you aren't going to have those types of intense, intense sanctions that lead up to criminal sanctions or lead up to, you know, removing a resident from the facility or the like. So that's essentially what we've identified as some of the main problems. Where we'd like to go is a system that, frankly, gets more to that transparency piece, gets more to justice for both the victim and for the provider who's dealing with the abuse system. One of the other things that I've seen in our system is that it can sometimes take years from the time an Adult Protective Services investigation begins to the time a final decision is made in our process system for that whole process to adjudicate. I've worked on cases where it was like 2.5 years between the time of the incident and the time of final resolution. And the problem with that, at least from the provider perspective, is they have access to due process. They have access to an administrative appeals process. But in the course of several years, you lose access to your evidence. People who are potential witnesses are aged and in the facility, so your evidence essentially erodes. People might have dementia. People who would be called on as witnesses are no longer living in the facility. Caregivers move to different jobs. So that's another problem that I think we have because of the complexity of it.
And so I think that, you know, we can work on, and Freda and I have talked over the years about working on a system that gets potentially a little bit more granular. And I know I'm sitting here kind of, you know, talking about complexity, and then I use the word granular, and that might not sound like a simplification.
Good job.
But I think that if we go back to the Resident Safety Review Council report, you can see where talking about that granularity doesn't necessarily make it more complex, because they're talking about, you know, basically looking at, can we break out some of these issues and incidents as adverse events rather than as abuse? And the finding there was yes. And then the other issue is, will that lead to potentially triaging some of these issues that end up being more confrontational and more litigious, and make them and put them more into a quality improvement type of a realm? So I think that when we're talking about the overall goals, we're talking about probably transparency, enhanced justice for both the victims and the providers who are dealing in the system, and finally quality improvement, because I think that that would be another area where if we have the regulators more engaged in that realm, you have opportunities for quality improvement.
Could I add one more to that list?
Sure.
And that is actually from the consumer perspective, to have them be able to understand all of these very complex issues in a way that either residents themselves can feel more empowered in the process, or the family members that are advocating on their behalf, you know, not only get swifter resolution, but really can understand in plain English how this all comes together.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that there's also a potential issue for the consumer, because, you know, one of the things in our that's within our system is when a provider has a substantiated abuse go against them, it goes onto a public website, public database that's searchable, and it's a web-based tool that the department maintains. And by going out on that web page and searching providers within some sort of geographic region, you do see the number of abuse citations that the providers will have in that area. And one of the things that I've noticed is that I think it's fair to say quite a few of the providers have one or more abuse citations. And so for a consumer trying to decide amongst various different providers, which one of these facilities do I place my loved one in? Do I place it in the facility that has only one abuse citation, or four, or three? And so it also becomes difficult contextualizing that information and understanding who the quality providers are in your area, and then who the providers are that have some work to do to kind of reach that bar of quality that everybody wants for their loved ones who are going to live in a long-term care facility.
I could just interject here for a second. First of all, I want to make sure our senators have a chance to ask any questions you want at this point before we move on of these two, because the definition part is going to be such an important part of our work. If there are no comments or questions.
No, my only comment would be it's nice to have people who have been thinking about this for a long time, because that's how you get to the best solutions. And when you come to definitions in particular, when it's the first chance or push and blush at them, they're usually wrong, and you have a lot of work to do around it. So I'm happy to see that we have some expertise that's been here for a while thinking about exactly what this definition should look like. And I do like the idea of separating some so that we can. It's the same thing with when you're in schools or whatever. You know, you want to make the environment the safest it can possibly be for all people. And so the issue that's an accident that may look like abuse, and everybody comes to the understanding it was an accident, needs to be in a different category than abuse. So I like that definition and the conversation.
I am glad that that Fred's had 5 years to think about this, and we're finally
putting it to work.
That's right.
It's not true. But
stalwart in our group.
I'd make one comment,
please.
Too. I think my frustration, when I get constituent calls, it's primarily, well, there are two families that I'm thinking of right now, where the relationship between the elder and their parents is not good. And so other caregivers come in, and in both cases took them to the bank, basically, took all of their savings. And how you do that when he doesn't really have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or, you know, any kind of mental deficiency, but there's obviously deterioration, and I don't know how that can fit into a definition of abuse, but to me, it is abuse by outside people to the elder by scamming them.
Well, if I could address part of that, please. One of the statutes I've been using for financial crimes in the exact circumstances that you've described is criminal mistreatment in the first degree. It's a felony charge. It's one of those that's on the never-never list that we fixed in this last House bill, which means if this individual hops to a different care facility, they're going to get picked up on it. So I've made it a priority to charge that particular crime since then. Another nice attribute about it is that all you have to do is access the money and transfer it, manipulate it. And you don't even have to prove a lot of the elements of a theft. You can just show that you took the money, and in many of these instances, when you talk to these folks, they always categorize it as a loan. You know, the senior citizen is loaning me money, or it's a gift. It was gifted to me. And the nice thing about that statute is you just have to show that it wasn't used for the benefit of the senior citizen, that the money was transferred and spent on bills, credit cards, gambling, whatever it might be. And that's especially when it's so prolific and you can't tell where these transactions are occurring. That's why I mentioned earlier the issue of venue becomes so frustrating to victims. That's the one thing I hear from victims consistently is, I'm being juggled to all these different police departments, but I live in your city. Why can't you help me?
Senator, your comment both shows how complex this can be, and I think also underlines how important this definition piece is. And I would say I wanted to make sure that folks understood what Joe was talking about, the Resident Safety Review Council. That was a huge part of 4084. Is that right? Did I get the right number?
Yeah.
And their product, in some ways, is this report that many have around the table, and I commend it to you all for nighttime reading. But it is a very good report, and it represents a whole lot of work. Normally, we would have Bethany here to give her PowerPoint on it. She's not available today, but if there's anybody both on the phone or around the group that hasn't seen this or would like to see it, please let us know. We'll make sure you get a copy of it. But it's a very important piece to setting up, moving into the definition part. And I think nobody understands that better than our able legislative counsel at Beliza, who knows we need to move to this piece. In some ways, we got ahead of ourselves, and I don't regret any of the work that we've done. It would have been nice to have this definition done, but in Oregon, it wasn't done, and it was complex. Now, with some of these wheels turning, and I think actually providing prevention, we have the opportunity to go back and get this right in statute, both for the practical side and to unify the statute in this regard. So I'm very excited about this work group and who we select or who wants to be on it. I am not minimizing the other half of what I think we'll be doing, because we'll have two work groups, as Representative Hoyle mentioned. And the last thing I would like to say is that John Wentworth, who we heard, I don't know if John's still there, but John's up in Clackamas County. He's been a very able member of our group for some time. He's an assistant district attorney, and he's going to continue to help us. However, his trial schedule is heating up. We're not going to see him as often maybe as we did last time, but he is still going to check in with us, and perhaps after the work groups bring back their findings to the group, he can check in with us. John, we really appreciate it. We understand you got a lot going on up there, but what I particularly appreciate is the resources that Clackamas has. You alluded to how big their program is. You've been very sensitive. You heard this part in one of the presentations. He's been very sensitive to rural counties all over Oregon and how we can engage them with these other groups. So, John, thank you very much.
You bet. I'll help however I can. My career started in Coos County, so I have a particular affinity for small counties.
Where's that located? I don't know. Great. So, Madam Chair.
Do we have a quorum yet?
I don't believe we're going to have a forum today. And if I may, if you were on the work group and appointed in 2011, you need to go through the process again for reappointment. It expires after 2 years. This is a new work group. So if you need an interest form, let me know. I will get it to you. And that's one of the holdups right now, is that there are interest forms that are out that haven't come back. There are people who don't know that they need interest forms, and that was just sent to me.
Perfect.
So, again, this is just all informational and not a formal meeting because we haven't adopted rules yet, but still quite productive. And with that, we will have two work groups. One will again be dealing with definitions to discuss the and put forward the definition of abuse. Representative Gilliam will use one of his two LC drafts that are available for February to submit a bill. We'll submit that in December once we have some language that we're putting forward. It's going to be a fairly aggressive schedule in terms of this work group. If you'd like to serve in this work group, let us know. The second work group will be, again, working on increased public awareness, community education, 211, how do we tie into the 211 system, and also Senator Knope, we spoke about it earlier, we spoke about it at our meeting yesterday, but to see if we can do something to do what other states have done with the Silver Alert, which is similar to Amber Alert, and it seems like that would fit in with this second work group to address that issue and see if we could, somehow tie in your idea to that. So let us know whether you want to be on work group one or two. Again, increase public awareness, I would think, for banks, credit unions. You have already a lot of material and are working on this issue, so we would hope that you would apply to be on the second work group. Great, and then we'll get back to people. We are not going to keep you more than an hour. We anticipate that the subcommittee working on abuse definitions will meet weekly until we get that definition. So it is an aggressive schedule, but we want to get something done, and we want to have a bill for February. So let me know which group you want to be on, and then we will let the large group know who's on what committee.
Yes.
Thank you for your time. Go team. All right, thank you on the phone as well.
So,
thank you.
He's on
thank
two, you. I'll be on one. And it's not good. On two, I'll be on one. And it's not good.